Captain Featherstone Del Grill 2. We were talking about your time as a midshipman aboard HMS Rodney from 39 through into 40. Could you tell us a bit about the atmosphere of the gun room? And also, we're interested in this question as to whether this business of evolutions, which is sort of bullied in some ways.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
Was that what was the atmosphere like?
We'd grown out of that now, even then we'd grown out of it in the Navy. I know you read about it in books, things like Fork in the Beam and all these other stuff. No, we'd grown out of that by then. But you had a sub-lieutenant in charge of the gunroom, and you jolly soon learnt if any of your behaviour was considered out of place. But it was done without any sort of bullying or anything like that. You were, officers don't bully each other by and large. And so you would give them a sharp talking to if necessary.
Could you describe the gun room? I mean, its layout.
Well, it was a large compartment with a large table in the middle around which you sat for your meals, and some armchairs and benches, padded benches and so forth. It wasn't as comfortable as a sort of pub saloon bar, but it was pleasant enough. And it had its own sort of pantry and so forth for the stewards.
Could you describe the food, what the sort of food you'd get was?
Oh, fairly, nothing very thrilling in the way of food, no. You could drink sherry, but you were not allowed spirits until you were 21. But you never drank to excess, I can tell you, because you'd have been jumped on extremely heavily and your mess bill would have been stopped, or your wine bill, rather, would have been stopped at any side of overindulging in sherry.
So what were your daily duties as a midshipman then?
Well, you were
in port, perhaps.
In port, well, there was always a midshipman of the watch. Let's say he was under the officer of the watch and was responsible for making sure that certain things happened or didn't happen.
Now, what would that be? If you were midshipman of the watch, what would you have to do?
You'd be on the quarterdeck most of the time, or else you were sent on errands by the officer of the watch. You would be responsible for making sure that the routine pipes were made over the broadcasting system for sailors' sort of standing periods, whatever it may be. One midshipman was always told off as a so-called commander's doggy, D-O-G-G-I-E, which meant that you had to follow him around all day and do such things as he required. And depending on whether you had a kindly commander or not, that was quite fun, or not, as the case may be.
So that's midshipman of the watch, commander's doggy. What other thing? What other duties?
Well, of course, you at sea. You were on the bridge, or you might be told off to do a period in the engine room. So you learned a bit about.
Well, let's take those separately. What would you be doing on the bridge?
On the bridge, you'd be writing up the deck log, probably, recording everything that goes on in the ship, keeping a good lookout. Running any sort of errands that the officer of the watch or the captain wanted run, and generally keeping your eyes and ears open and learning all the time.
And in the engine room?
Well, there again, you went down there to learn something about how the engine room department runs, whether it be in the boiler rooms or the engine rooms, and you expect to know the layout of all the piping systems, both steam and hydraulic, in the ship. It was part of your education.
One thing we haven't mentioned, and that's because I forgot to ask you a thing, navigation. I should have mentioned it more when you were at college, but can we talk about navigational training, and we'll stretch that back to Dartmouth and then take it forward onto the Rodney, if you don't mind.
Well, as regards navigation at sea, you had to take a number of sights of the sun and the stars with a sextant and fix the ship's position. And you'd have to do that probably every day for a period, so that you eventually were quite competent at deciding where the ship was. As well as astro-navigation, of course, there was ordinary navigation on passage, taking bearings of lighthouses and other things, and again fixing the ship's position and making allowance for tides and currents, so that you steer the ship in the right direction to take account of them.
Now, when had you done the trigonometry?
You started that at Dartmouth. You'd done all the theoretical and the sort of mathematical side of navigation at Dartmouth.
Now, it's not particularly difficult, but some people have trouble with it. In fact, I do. Did you have trouble with the mathematics of trigonometry?
No, it was once you understand sines and cosines and cosecants and all the other things, it wasn't too bad.
So no. It was never something you were struggling with?
Never afraid of it. But the more you did it, the faster you got in working out the results of the site.
Anything else about the sort of routine of life before the war broke out aboard the Rodney? I mean, where were you based mainly? Was it just a...
Well, we started off at... I joined it down at Devonport. But we fairly soon went up north for Scythe and Scarborough Flow because you could see the war was coming. And Portland, of course, was another principal base where I went really for gunnery practice.
Tell me about gunnery practice. I mean, that's...
My position was down in the bowels of the ship in the compartment known as the transmitting station, which was where there was what we'd call today an enormous calculator, except it was about the size of a normal dining table, manned by, I suppose, about 12 people, which I was one. Not all officers, and in particular Royal Marines.
Could you explain how the whole system worked? Had it moved on from the Dumaresques and the rest of it?
Oh, heavens, yes.
Could you describe what system they were using in 1939?
Well, Rodney didn't have radar at that time. She didn't have gunnery control radar. She had air warning radar, but no gunnery control radar. And so it all started with the director, which is that great big armoured tower up the mast, which showed the direction and the range of the enemy, because you had the rangefinder up there, away rangefinder. You, in fact, had several rangefinders. The enemy's course and speed had very much to be estimated by eye. Although later on there was a thing called the plot, which is a sort of automatic plotting table, and if you plotted the range or the range and the bearing of the enemy, you could eventually deduce what its speed and course were.
But that wasn't then. How did that come in?
You got that then, yes, but it was entirely visual. You hadn't got any radar information. It was all optical rangefinders.
And how was this transmitted? This was transmitted.
It was transmitted electrically. Down to this enormous fire control table.
What did the fire control table look like for you, and what were you doing on it?
I was doing the range plot, in fact. There were about five range finders in the Rodney. There was one in each turret, and one up the mast, and another one somewhere else, I forget where, in the conning tower, that's right. And they all produced ranges of the target. And the thing I worked... produced a sort of mean range from all these range finders, because didn't all necessarily record the same thing. And also, as the range altered, I was able to say, I think your enemy is altering course away or towards or wherever it might be. Anyway, that was my job, and I seemed to do it all right. The gunnery officer was quite satisfied. And there it was.
So you just watched this machine, or...?
Well, it was ticking away all the time and making marks on a roll of paper. I occasionally was up on the bridge, you know, when the guns were going off. It was quite a big bang, a 16-inch gun.
What would you be doing on the bridge if you were on action stations on the bridge?
I'd be the midshipman of the watch, I should think, probably.
So, dog's body.
A bit of a dog's body, that's right. Keep you out of the way, except when told to do something.
Any other particular duties you might have that we haven't picked up on?
No, I mean, one's training continued the whole time, you know, whether it be on doing Morse exercises or signal flags or seamanship exercises, you know, being there when the anchors were weighed and so forth, or when boats were being hoisted.
You were still working hard at the general seamanship?
Absolutely, oh yes. But you were expected to take part in any sort of thing which contributed towards your education in your business.
So you'd be added to the seamen? Would you be added
well,
to...
Well, not or? Added to them, no. No, but in charge of them, which is, you know, starting off in power of command, as you might say, and taking charge of things, both emergencies and routine.
So things like raising the anchor?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because a lot of these things aren't as simple as they sound,
yeah,
are
not,
they?
Absolutely. You know, if you get a foul anchor or you pick something up and pick the anchor up and find you've got a telegraph cable or something high across it, all sorts of things can happen.
And you coped with what was thrown at you?
Well, that's right. Absolutely. Yes, you jolly well did, or else.
Any particular incidents you remember?
No, life was fairly was fairly energetic, but there were no panics at it, as I can remember.
Now, can I ask if you were aware of the approach of war? I mean, you were you were a very young midshipman, but things had been going on in Germany by then for 6 years. Were you, before the war broke out, were you aware of what was going on and the seriousness of it?
Well, I'll tell you this, that every midshipman has to write up a thing called, has to keep a journal, and mine is on that shelf behind you. And not only did you have to record everything that you did and the ship did and the fleet did, but you had at every end of every week to write up a little sort of resume of the international situation. And reading through that journal now, you can see a sort of trend towards a war coming. So to that extent, you were very much keen, very much encouraged to read the papers, the newspapers. Not the tabloids so much as the broadsheets, I think they call them, and keep yourself up to date with both domestic and particularly international affairs.
Did you have any particular views about Germany, about Hitler, about the Nazi, the National Socialist Party?
No, not at that stage.
But you were aware that they were a threat, or that Germany was a threat?
Aware that Germany was a threat, yes.
And... what happened as the war approached in the last weeks? You moved up to Scapa before the war broke out.
We did. We actually, I think we were... Oh, I could look it up now, but we were either at Rosyth or at Scapa. I think probably at Scapa, yes.
And do you remember the day war broke out? Did you hear the broadcast?
On the day war broke out, I was on the bridge of the Rodney, and we were about... 100 miles south of Iceland, looking for the Scharnhorst and Neisenau, which we'd been led to believe were out. They weren't, luckily. And I was on the bridge at 11 o'clock, and this signal came through Total Germany, which was the code word for commence hostilities against Germany. And there was comparative calm on the bridge. Nobody sort of burst into tears had to go to the loo or anything like that. I suppose because it was expected. We'd been through the Munich thing with Chamberlain and whatnot and got terribly excited then. And so it didn't come as a sort of hammer blow. We were expecting it.
And that's how you felt personally?
Well, I wouldn't have said there was any sort of emotion on the bridge or in the ship because we were, we all prepared for it. We got a good ship and we knew the guns went off properly and... we were prepared, we were well trained for it.
Was there any aspect that you were looking forward to, that you actually welcomed the outbreak of
the war? Oh, certainly not. No, there was no gung-ho about it at all. Absolutely none.
So it's just an acceptance of what...
Acceptance, that's what you're paid for, that's what we're here for, and that's what the Navy does when the shooting starts.
What do you remember about the first weeks of the war then? I mean, for you?
Well, we were at sea most of the first week. And then we came back to Scarborough Flow to fuel, because one always has to keep the tanks topped up.
Could you tell us a bit about refueling? I mean, it used to be such a big thing with coaling, but the Rodney was oil.
Absolutely. Tanker came alongside you, connected up the hose and pumped it in. That's all very simple.
Very simple.
All a matter for the engineers. The only interest we took was if this is a burst of pipe or something on the deck, and they covered the deck with oil. That's not very popular. But no, it was all over for the engineers.
And what was life like at Scapa? I mean, in the First World War, it had a dreadful reputation as being a dull...
Well, it was pretty boring. There was a... there were one or two playing fields where you go and kick a ball about or whatever it was.
On the island?
On the flotter, I think it was, and there was the fleet canteen there.
Would you get ashore to flotter?
I did once or twice, but no, there wasn't very much to do. What I did do, which is rather interesting, you remember after the First World War, the German fleet scuttled itself, and I went on board the wreck of the Derfflinger, the German battle cruiser, which was upside down and had been raised, which was rather fascinating. I brought back something, I forget what it was, a little sort of souvenir I managed to pick up from this Derfflinger. It's an enormous great thing, lying bottom up.
It was in process of being salvaged, was it?
Well, they were salvaging. They hadn't started on her, actually, except to raise her. But they hadn't started to take her to bits. British Metal Industries, I think, from...
Which way up was she?
Bottom up. Completely bottom up.
So you just...
You walked on the upturned hull, yes. A lot of fun. Otherwise, there weren't many excitements up at Scarpa. And then, of course, as soon as the Norwegian campaign started, we were over.
That's all sort of 5 or 6 months. So it was sort of like four or five months at Scapa, basically.
Yes, I should think about that, yes.
And what would you be doing in port? I mean, for you, I mean, as a midshipman, still training, I presume?
Oh, still training, oh, heavens yes. Yep. It was fairly boring stuff. I mean, we were going out quite often. We didn't stick in port all the time. You know, we'd go out on offensive sweeps with one of the battle cruisers or something like that.
What were the sweeps like?
Well, they were usual boring. You wouldn't see very much. But you were out there in case the Germans did...
Is that into the
Atlantic, basically.
So very different from the First World War, where they'd swept into the North Sea. This was the other way.
Yeah. Mm.
Did you have an opinion yourself? Not now. I mean, now you will have, obviously. But did you then have an opinion about the relative efficiency of British and German ships as to whether the Bismarck and the Tirpitz were better than the Rodney? Whether the the relative levels of warship design.
At that stage, we didn't know much about the Bismarck and Tirpitz. They were, I'm not sure whether they were even in commission then. I don't think they were. But no, we knew about the pocket battleships, which of course started off their war with the Graf Spee. And we reckoned that they were as good as us, probably, in sort of things like gunnery and damage control, etc. Oh yes, they weren't to be underestimated at all.
So you didn't feel that your ship was intrinsically superior to a German?
Well, only that we had 16-inch guns and the Germans didn't. I mean, they hadn't got anything as big as the Rodney at that stage. Because their big battleships hadn't been built.
While you were on the Rodney, did you take any examinations, qualifying examinations? Or was that later? Were you still a midshipman when you went on the Jervis?
I was still a midshipman then, yes. No, I didn't take any more examinations, no.
Now, one thing which we haven't dealt with is you were sometimes attached to some of the drifters. Luna Bow and Whirlpool are mentioned.
Every battleship, or every major warship, usually had a drifter attached to it. And it was a converted herring drifter. It had a 3-pounder gun in the bows and a couple of depth charges in the stern. And the drifter was used for taking sailors ashore, large bodies of sailors, for bringing off provisions and things like that, and generally doing anything which was required. But when we were at Loch Ewe, particularly, which was the base used after the Royal Oak was sunk, then you had to patrol the entrance to the loch. They had anti-submarine net there, and you had to patrol that, because if a submarine tried to get in, the net was so arranged that it would ignite a flare on it. And in fact, one night, the flare did ignite, and we set off, and I dropped a depth charge in the middle of the channel, which didn't go off. I was told by the captain, who was a sub-lieutenant, to set a depth of 250 feet, which I duly did. But, of course, there wasn't 250 foot of water. So there was a lot of nail-biting going on. And at 5:30 the next morning, there was the most thunderous explosion, and luckily the depth charge went off. But that was it. But we didn't sink any submarine. Anyway, that was all good fun.
Did you enjoy the attachments to the drifters?
Immensely, yes. One became a bit of a pirate. You know, dress regulations weren't observed quite so carefully. You went around rather dressed as a fisherman.
And how did you get on with the small crews?
Oh, fine. All very much buddies together, yeah. Oh, yes.
Well, we missed it, rather, but just to drop back to it. What impact did the sinking of the Royal Oak have on you? I mean, on you and generally?
Well, I suppose it was a shock. I remember I was in the gunroom and the Padre came down and said, I got some bad news for you chefs. The Royal Oak has been sunk. And we sort of said, you know, what good heavens lie? How come? It came as a bit of almost beyond belief that a German submarine could get into Scarpa Flow. And that beyond belief, a good many people, not just us. And so it was sort of a shock disbelief at first. I forget where we were at the time. We weren't certainly in Scarpa Flow. Maybe we were at the site, but I can't remember. I can look it up in my journal. But no, it was a complete shock that a submarine could get in and do that.
So what's the next thing you remember then? Would that be when you, in February 40, you go to HMS Jervis?
Yes, I should think so, yes.
Now, is that a detachment, or is that that's your next post?
As a midshipman, you always went and did time in destroyers after you had a certain amount of time in big ships. And so I joined the Jervis in Immingham, on the east coast, in the Humber. She was the leader of the 7th Destroyer Flotilla, under the famous man, Captain Philip Mack, who was, I suppose, the most famous of the destroyer captains in the whole of the Navy at that time.
Yeah, and what was the 7th Destroyer Flotilla was actually based at Immingham, was it?
She was, yes.
That's where they stayed.
The J class.
And what were your first impressions of the Jervis?
Very different from the Rodney. No, but she was a happy ship, had a very highly qualified flotilla staff, I sat in the director as the rate officer or something in action, which luckily we never had to do.
What did that involve? Can you just explain?
The rate officer has to keep an eye on the enemy and decide its changes of course and speed.
What did you do? Do you remember how you...
Oh, you were passing it down a telephone to the transmitting station down below. The sort of calculator, you know, the computer.
And what were conditions like on the Jervis in comparison, perhaps, to the battleship?
Well, I didn't have a cabin. I slung a hammock, same as I did on the in the Rodney. But I didn't complain. It was a normal thing to expect. All the midshipmen did that sort of thing. But I was treated perfectly well, kicked around like midshipmen are, learned the hard way. But, of course, there wasn't quite so much opportunity for training at that time because, you know, there was a war on. We were over to Norway pretty quickly.
So what would a typical... how did destroyer routine differ? I mean, would you just have to...
Well, being a smaller ship, you were thrown together much closer and treated rather more respectfully, I suppose you might say, than you were as a midshipman in a great big battleship. you weren't subjected to so much supervision. You were expected to do things without having to be told, and that to make decisions which, without going and asking, you know, what the answer was.
Did you prefer it on a smaller ship?
I think one always does. It's a more, you know, you knew the names of people much quicker and things like that. Oh, yes.
Now, what impression, I mean, I know you're very junior, the most junior officer. What were your impressions of Philip Mack?
Well, a formidable chap, but I mean, one of the finest seamen in the Navy. And if you watched him enough and did what he did and thought as he thought, you would go a long way. He was an absolute ace.
And it was clear. What was he then, a Commodore?
A four-strike captain. Captain D, yeah.
And, I mean, would he speak to you, or were you...
Lord, yes, absolutely. But he was the most marvellous ship handler. You know, he handled this thing as a rowing boat. Marvellous.
He was literally... He was noticeably better than other people.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, he made an enormous name for himself in the Mediterranean in later years, as you probably know.
Would he try and tell you... Did he try and share his knowledge with you? I mean, you know...
He would...
By example.
He would draw it out of you. You know, he'd sort of say, you know, do you know what that thing is over there? Or what sort of ship do you reckon that is? Or what's the best way of doing this? He would, yes, by example and by... what's the word I'm off? I'm not quite sure. Yeah, probing your knowledge, I think, and thereby teaching you things.
But not threateningly?
Absolutely not. Oh, no, not unless you were an absolute abject idiot, in which case he would roar at you, probably. But, the softly, softly catchy monkey, I think they say.
And what was your action stations was the rate officer. What was your cruising station, or would that... You know,
I can't remember now. This is too many years ago, 60 years ago.
So what was the basic before you went to Norway? What was the 7th Destroyer Flotilla basically doing?
We were doing East Coast convoys.
Tell us a bit about them. What were they like?
They were very slow, and we're going from the Tyne up to the Forth, a lot of them, or further north. In one long line, because of course there were minefields all the way up the east coast, and so long was the line of the ships, you couldn't see the front of it from the back or the back from the front. If anything had happened at the back, you wouldn't even know about it unless the SOS was sent out. So it was really rather pointless. But of course there was a threat from aircraft, German aircraft, not very many of them. And E-boats, but we in fact never saw any action on that. And we finally had a fearful collision. We were rammed by a merchant ship and very nearly sank.
What do you remember of that, the incident?
Which river?
What do you remember of the collision?
What do I remember? Well, I was on the bridge at the time we hit.
Whose fault was it?
We weren't showing any lights. And this merchant ship, which was a Swedish ship, was just showing one white, bright white light. But in those days, one was jolly tired, you know. We were working 4 hours on, 4 hours off, all around the clock. And we didn't sort of register until suddenly I saw the bows of the ship heading for our port anchor. And it hit us. And there was a most almighty flash as our degaussing gear fused. And the ship took a sort of bow down angle a bit. And the merchant ship then proceeded to bump down our side and disappeared into the darkness.
So it was a near head-on collision?
Near head-on.
How bad was the impact? I mean,
oh, a hell of a... It made a hole big enough to drive a double-decker bus through. He was a whopper. So anyway, he came to a halt, and I went down to the what they call the iron deck, the sort of main deck of the ship, because a lot of sailors in the water had been washed out through the hole in the side. This was in the middle of the night. And so I heard a shout in the water alongside, and I threw a life buoy attached to a rope to this chap, and we hauled him in. But we lost We lost quite a few sailors in that.
Do you know the date?
I can turn it up, but I can't tell you. It was February